Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This podcast exists because of the paid members at DecodingTV.com. Become a paid member and get ad-free episodes as well as early access to episodes. Thanks to everyone at DecodingTV.com who makes this podcast possible.
There's a reason I'm telling you this. My mother, my children, New Year's Eve, you'll be reluctant to accept it or believe it, but I promise you, every single piece is important. We buried my boy today. And almost nobody came. This time. Sixth coffin I've put in the dirt. In less than 2 weeks.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Streaming, a Decoding TV podcast. I'm David Chen, and I'm going to be replaced by Bruce Greenwood halfway through this podcast episode. Joining me today is Sarah Morris.
I'm Sarah Morris, and I would love to be haunted by Carlo Gugino.
Each week, This Week in Streaming, we'll cover a show that's new and interesting in the world of streaming. We'll tell you if it's worth watching, and if it is, we'll review and spoil and discuss the entire season of the show. Today, we are discussing Mike Flanagan's The Fall of the House of Usher, a new 8-part miniseries available right now on Netflix. All episodes are available. We have watched all episodes. We're going to start today by talking about our overall thoughts on the show. And we'll do that in a non-spoilery fashion. And then we are going to spoil the entire season and kind of go through episode by episode and share our thoughts on each episode of the show. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. And find us across all platforms at Decoding TV. We're on YouTube, Instagram, Threads, and so forth. So I do want to address the fact that typically on This Week in Streaming, we cover like the first episode or the first few episodes of the show, and then later on we cover the whole show. I did consider doing that, but as I started watching The Fall of the House of Usher, it just became clear that it would just make more sense to do it this way. You just watch the whole thing, talk about overall thoughts, and then talk about, you know, spoil everything, because it really does feel like a whole unit, right? Sarah Morris, don't you think this is like an 8-hour movie, as they might say?
Yeah, it's so interesting to me. I think Mike Flanagan is really good at this. I think this is one of his talents as a writer, particularly when he writes for episodic television, is people will talk about prestige drama series like it's an 8-hour movie, and it never is. It's 8 hours of television, but Mike Flanagan does have a way of making his stories, like, these are definitely episodes. There are arcs contained within each of the 8 episodes. It is episodic, and yet the way it's paced, the way it's edited, with there's flashbacks, there's kind of cross-cutting stories of the different siblings, the way it's edited, the way it's paced, the story elements that are parceled out in each episode, it really moves like an 8-hour movie.
Yeah,
it's a cognitive dissonance to me because it is an episodic show, and yet it feels like a very cohesive, like I plowed through all 8 episodes.
Yeah.
And didn't feel like I had just sat there and watched seven hours and whatever minutes of TV. Like, it felt like it moved really fast.
I got through all 8 hours in like 3 to 4 days. So I would agree. And by the way, the notion of a TV show as an 8-hour movie or a 10-hour movie has often been used in a pejorative fashion these days, right? Like, it's people say it because essentially using it in a negative way is saying, hey, you don't know how to structure an episode of TV. You're just basically, there's no discipline. We're just making an 8-hour long film and we're just arbitrarily chopping it up into like 8 distinct units. But I agree with you that what Flanagan is great at doing is he's able to achieve both. I think it is episodic television. Each episode is a self-contained thing, and yet they all go towards telling this broader story. That is one area where I think The Fall of the House of Usher really succeeds.
I think that, like, it's an 8-hour movie has been used two ways. One, the way you describe, which is to say, like, a lot of people from film over the last 15, 20 years have come into the world of TV, and they were clearly just writing a 200-page script and then arbitrarily cutting where right. things end. But it was also used in the sense of there was long the film-TV divide, and film was considered superior to TV. Yeah. And as TV has become more the home of character-driven storytelling, it was like, oh, it's an 8-hour movie, was also kind of used as this would have been a movie 20 years ago. And now mm-hmm. it's a 6-part, 8-part TV show because yeah. these movies don't get made anymore.
Yeah, indeed. But whatever the case, that's, as you said, I think it's something Mike Flanagan excels at. He is making episodic TV, but he's also making something that is a cohesive whole.
So he just yeah. seems to have a good instinct, and it starts at the writing level of how yeah. to parcel information.
Yeah.
So that you have both an episodic contained arc for that particular episode and the larger narrative that is playing out over the course of the 8 episodes of this, or Midnight Mass. I thought Midnight Mass did the same kind of storytelling very well, where it's episodes, but you know, it still feels like a bigger story that again moves really fast.
Sarah Mars, let's get into it. Let's talk about The Fall of the House of Usher. We are going to talk with no spoilers for what happens, but I am going to reveal the premise of the show and kind of the mechanics of how the show works. So I have to really mention that if we're going to have any kind of meaningful discussion about it.
I would be super interested in your regular listeners in their opinion on this, because I feel like, especially dealing with TV, if it's information contained in the first 2 episodes, it is not a spoiler. It is the foundation of the story.
Sure. Sure. But I think people can define spoilers any number of ways. I'm just going to be upfront with you about what's going on. So we are going to reveal the premise. We're going to reveal foundational plot elements of the show. And then later we will do episode by episode and spoil all the episodes at once. So here we go. In The Fall of the House of Usher, Mike Flanagan is back with another Gothic horror series, this time adapting some of the most famous works of Edgar Allan Poe. The Fall of the House of Usher reunites Flanagan with many of the actors who have starred in his series and films over the years, starting with Gerald's game pair, Bruce Greenwood and Carla Gugino, as a billionaire and the mysterious woman haunting him, respectively. Each episode adapts a different Poe short story in an interconnected narrative about the downfall of the family behind a corrupt pharmaceutical company and their opioid disaster drug called Ligodone. As the Ushers meet increasingly fraught fates, we're forced to ask if it's karma or if the Usher family really is cursed. So, without talking about any specific things that happen in the show, other than that, Sarah Mars, what did you think overall of The Fall of the House of Usher?
I mostly liked it. I have to admit, my expectations were very high because I have really enjoyed Mike Flanagan's work in the past. Both his
Are you a fan of Edgar Allan Poe? Are you a Poe head?
Oh, yes.
Sarah Mars, as am I. I'm a huge fan of Poe. Like, Poe was assigned in school, and then I would go buy like the complete works and like read Poe in my spare time, you know. So, huge fan of Edgar Allan Poe.
I have read the complete works, including all of his shitty poetry. And this time of year,
you're not implying that all of his poetry is bad. You're saying that some of his poems are bad and you've read
some of his poems are really bad. In general, his poetry is terrible. Some of it is really bad. Wow. Because he was writing it to get paid. You know, it was, he got paid per word. He would crank out a poem. It's nonsense. It's bad. He was a much better narrative writer than he was a poet. I do think the value, I had this conversation with an actual poet laureate once who was like really down on Poe's poetry. And my defense of Poe's poetry is it's not good. And I do think there are moments in The House of Usher where people are quoting from the poems and you're just like, oh, this is not good. But it's very accessible if you are either a child who maybe your first exposure to poetry is perhaps Poe. For me, I found a book in my dad's library that was the illustrated Edgar Allan Poe that included The Raven and Annabel Lee, but also City by the Sea, The Spirits of the Dead, and Ligeia. Those were some of the first poems I ever read. And for kids, they're really accessible. Is he William Blake? No. I would say Poe was actually probably closer to Shel Silverstein. where it's very rhymey, it's easy to memorize, it's catchy. And so again, if you're young and that's your first exposure to poetry, you're probably going to like it because the rhyming is instinctively pleasing. And mm-hmm. even if you're an adult, if you're older, if you're not somebody who reads poetry, if you maybe feel intimidated by poetry, if poetry feels inaccessible, Poe can be a really good place to start because, again, the threshold for entry with him is pretty low.
All right. So you're not a fan of Poe's poetry. You know, we'll just agree to disagree on that. But you're a bigger fan of his narrative stuff. What did you think of the show?
I generally really liked it. It's not Midnight Mass. I was like, after Midnight Mass, I'm just like, I don't know if I expected him to top it, but I was like, it's not Midnight Mass. But I do think there's a lot of really fun stuff in it. Especially this time of year, it is October, it is spooky season, we're 2 weeks away from Halloween. There are some amazing, not only Poe references, but there's like Vincent Price stuff in The House of Usher that I was really, it was fun. And I was like, this is really, like, he knows what he's doing, he's having fun. I thought the acting was great. You know, the performances are really, really good. It looks amazing. Like, really, all of his shows have incredible production design. So I just didn't think it was quite as deep or cohesive. Kind of my biggest, I have two sort of main gripes, I guess, with the show, which is one, this time around, he has done the multi-generational performances before, where there's one character portrayed across decades, and there's a younger actor and an older actor and a kid actor, and we see these same people throughout the years. That has worked to tremendous effect in shows like The Haunting of Hill House in particular, where there are the kids and the adults, a little bit in Bly Manor, and to an extent in Midnight Mass, there's a little bit of sort of people aging and, you know, that all happening. But in that case, they were just using prosthetics and makeup. In this one, I didn't feel in some of the key performances that there was a connect between the younger and older actors, that
Absolutely.
In a couple of critical cases, it felt like everyone was playing different characters in different shows.
So that was one of your issues, which I felt exactly the same way about that. And what was the other issue?
The other issue is, okay, so the premise of the show, there's the Usher family, and they are undergoing something. Something is happening to the Ushers. Is it supernatural? Is it just bad luck? You know, at the beginning, it's like, wow, what's going on with this family? Seems bad. They are a
bad. That's Sarah's review of the show.
They are a pharmaceutical billionaire empire along the lines of the Sacklers, who in real life are the family behind Purdue Pharma, which very infamously unleashed OxyContin into the world. And if you paid attention to the opioid crisis or any of the news about that over the last literal two decades, there have been memos, there have been emails revealed in various lawsuits. The Sacklers, who hold executive positions in their company, who are on the board of that company, they are in positions of power. They are not innocent bystanders. They knew oxycodone was dangerous. They knew it was addictive. They knew that their marketing was misleading when they said it was non-addictive, when they promised that it was a silver bullet for chronic pain. They knew it was none of those things. They put it on market anyway. And what is it, like 50-something thousand people have died from opioid overdoses since? Like, it's terrible and it's enraging. And it was legally ruled in court that they cannot be sued or held responsible for deaths resulting from OxyContin overdose. There will be no justice in the real world. And this whole setup of the fall of the House of Usher, as much as it is an adaptation of Poe, really feels like Mike Flanagan was just infuriated, as many people were, by the fact that the Sacklers will never face real justice. And the Ushers are, let's call it fictional street justice.
I mean, yes, I think it's not a spoiler to say terrible things happen. It's called The Fall of the House of Usher. So, like, terrible things happen to them. And you're saying that it feels like he's using these fictional characters as a way to,
as a stand-in for this catharsis.
Cathartically, yes.
Yeah.
But there is some value in that.
Yes.
But that it's maybe not the type of story one might be looking for, right?
So they have their drug. The Ushers have Ligodone, which is, I think, a portmanteau of Lygia, which that poem is about a woman who dies and her husband remarries. And then the second wife dies. And then the first wife, like, overtakes the second wife, and it's kind of mysterious. There's a lot of Poe's work is about like doppelgangers and what's real and who is like, what is the self and things like that. So Ligia kind of plays in that world, but it's ligodone. It's Ligia and oxycodone is the portmanteau for ligodone. Mm-hmm. And I just think like the idea of a show that is providing an emotional catharsis for the public of the Sacklers are never going to be held accountable. The worst thing that will happen to them in life is they will have their name taken off some cultural institutions, some museums, mm-hmm. libraries, et cetera, have taken their name off the building that they paid for. Not all, some. And oh my God, one time I heard that someone was mean to a Sackler kid on a playground in Manhattan. And I'm like, I don't care. Like, I know the kids are innocent, and this is actually the best thing I think the show does. We can get it into it later, but it's like the fact that like the kids aren't getting invited to the Upper East Side birthday parties anymore. I'm like, oh, boo hoo. How many parents have buried their children because you lied about your drug? Who cares? So I do feel like I understand where Mike Flanagan's coming from in terms of like, I feel this anger. There will be no justice. Let me imagine killing these people in just increasingly awful and fantastic ways. I totally get it. I don't think that fits Edgar Allan Poe particularly well. I think there's just a little bit of a mishmash that isn't quite cohesive. It isn't quite sitting together. Because again, so much of Poe's work is about the self. He gets into some of the stuff about hubris and regret. That's in there. It's in the mix. But so much of Poe's work is just about the self. How well do you know yourself? What is yourself? And when do you cross a line where you no longer recognize yourself? And so many of Poe's characters do these terrible things. And it's like they are doing them from a perspective of outside of their self, of not even understanding necessarily why they're doing something. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of using a horror gothic show to tell a story of imagined cathartic justice on a family like the Sacklers, I think there's a way to do it, but I don't think grafting Edgar Allan Poe onto it is the path. I think these are two separate things. I think there's the adaptation of Poe, and then there's this thing about the Ushers as a stand-in for the Sacklers, and that it probably should have been two different series, but I also feel like Mike Flanagan was fucking sick of Netflix and just wanted out of that deal, and this was his last thing, because he was on the picket lines all summer with the WGA, and he was pretty open about being unhappy with Netflix. Yeah. So
I don't even know if it'd be accurate to say this is an adaptation of Poe, right? Like, it feels a lot more like it's inspired by Poe than
I think a couple of the episodes are pretty good.
Yeah, like pretty close adaptations, but like others are not, right?
Right.
So we got to start, Sarah. I'll share some of my thoughts and then let's get to spoilers. So I want to begin by saying I think this miniseries is hugely ambitious. And I think Mike Flanagan is taking some big swings here. And it's actually like, I'm astonished that it works as well as it does in many ways. Because, you know, what he has done is he's taken like one story, The Fall of the House of Usher, he's made it the overarching story, moved it to modern day, taken a bunch of different Poe stories, and done like mini adaptations of each one, all of which need to like fit in with the broader narrative, also be modernized, and also deliver on horror thrills. Like that is the brief that he gave himself for this show. And I think for the most part, he achieves it. I think it is a very, it goes down easy. It's a breezy show to watch, assuming you kind of like the brand of horror that Mike Flanagan is selling. So I had a pretty good time with most of the show. I think that, you know, on the Filmcast podcast, I compared it to Seven, the David Fincher movie, where when you're watching the movie Seven, right, I think Seven is one of the great crime films of all time. There is a perverse curiosity in wanting to know how John Doe is going to kill all these different people for their sins. You're like, okay, like, So he fed this guy until he was bursting and then, you know, kicked his stomach and caused him to burst. Like, okay, that's one of the most awful things I've ever heard. What's the next one? You know, like your brain is kind of like, I kind of am curious what the next one's going to be. Similar dynamic here where there is this perverse curiosity, this morbid curiosity of, oh, I kind of want to know how he adapts like the murders of the Rue Morgue.
Yeah.
And uses it to kill one of the people in the show. You know, like, how is he going to do that? That's interesting, you know? And so there is this hook that, like, really keeps you coming back and keeps you, like, wanting to know how this all ends. And a lot of the horror sequences are well done. As you indicated, I think the show looks great. And it's well directed. The cast is awesome. Very talented actors here. My big problem with this show is, I think tonally it is a mess. I think that there are some actors who don't even appear to be acting in the same, not even show, same type of show. Like, some of the performances verge on camp. If not, like, it left me questioning, is it supposed to be camp? Like, is it supposed to be
Well, you can't, campy, you know? You can't intentionally be camp.
Right, sure, but okay, fair enough. But maybe they were trying for it, right? And
I would use the word schlock.
Yeah,
I think there's a lot of schlock, and it does veer into camp. But I think some of the actors got the script and understood it to be schlocky, and that's what they were playing. And then some of them were like, this is intense, serious drama, and that's what they're playing. And those things do not fit.
It felt like half of these actors are in a different show than the other half, and that was a real problem. The show is really earnest, you know. As you said, you have characters reciting poetry into the screen, into the camera, right? And it's like, we're just going to pose language, we're just going to put it out there front and center, and not many shows dare do that. Wes Anderson with Roald Dahl recently did that for his Henry Sugar shorts on Netflix, and it's like a similar, it's like very earnest. It's like, hey, we love this language. We're going to share it with you in its original form. You know, like, that's it's rare to see a show that does that. But yeah, tonally, I think it's not great. At various times, I didn't really understand kind of what feel the show was going for. And also, I do think Flanagan's grasp exceeds his grasp occasionally. Like, there was one or two too many subplots in this show. Not every single subplot paid off in a satisfying way, right? So it's messy, it's rough around the edges, but it's also hugely ambitious, and I think he gets the job done. At the end of the day, I feel good recommending this, but this is one of the least favorite things that Mike Flanagan has made in my, like, one of my least favorite things Mike Flanagan has made. What about you? Let's wrap this up before we get to the spoilers.
It's probably middle of the road for me. I think Midnight Mass was worse.
you thought Midnight Mass was worse?
No, not Midnight
than this.
Mass. I'm sorry, Midnight Club.
Yeah,
Midnight Club.
Yes,
Midnight Mass is the pinnacle.
Yeah, I think we all think Midnight Mass is a masterpiece. Like, it's one of my favorite things I've ever watched.
Midnight Mass is amazing. Midnight Club, the Christopher Pike adaptation, which actually I thought had very similar problems to Fall of the House of Usher. In terms of the performances are kind of all over the place. The tone is kind of all over the place. And I wonder, like, how fed up was Mike Flanagan and he just wanted out of his Netflix deal and he is just cranking this stuff out? Because I feel like House of Usher with like six more months of drafts in the scripting stage, he is too good of a writer. I have too much faith in him as a writer and a generally intelligent person who clearly really loves Poe.
Mm-hmm. I think that this represented his best.
Yeah, I think with a little bit more work, a lot of these issues could have been addressed. I think COVID complications, I have heard this from people who worked on other series around 2021, late 2020, 2021, 2022, when people were kind of still having to bubble and work under very kind of complicated conditions in which Usher was made. They were one of the productions that had to stop and resume. and they had other problems going on too. Like they just faced a lot of problems.
Yeah. They had to fire their lead actor.
And like, that might be why some of the performances aren't meshing.
Right. They don't match. It's like, what? Maybe they came back after some time and decided we're going to go a different way with this, you know?
Well,
like,
and if you had a performance that a character only crosses paths, some of the actors, the characters are fairly isolated from each other by the story. And if your character only crosses paths with Bruce Greenwood playing Roderick Usher, the patriarch of the family, which was originally Frank Langella, who was fired halfway through production, they went back and refilmed the Langella scenes with Bruce Greenwood, who is one of the people who I thought read the script and went, schlock, Vincent Price, got it, okay. I think there's a really good chance some of these performances, some of what we're seeing was calibrated to whatever Frank Langella was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce Greenwood came in with a different take. And now those performances aren't meshing.
Mm-hmm.
And they only reshot. They did not reshoot, as I understand it, they did not reshoot the whole thing. They only reshot Frank Langella's scenes with Bruce Greenwood. So if you had like filmed one scene with Frank Langella, he gets fired. They're going to reshoot that one scene with Bruce Greenwood, but the rest of your performance, which might well be calibrated off what you were taking in from Frank Langella playing your father.
Yeah.
No longer makes sense with what Bruce Greenwood is doing, which is, I thought, very borderline camp in the vein of like, if you've ever seen the Vincent Price Halloween specials or like.
You thought Bruce Greenwood's performance was camp?
Oh, by the end, we can get there, but yes.
Okay, I disagree completely. I think he took this deadly seriously.
Oh, I think he took it. Look, this is the thing about camp. It is so misaligned, and schlock is misaligned. I think Bruce Greenwood, one, is a fantastic actor. I think he is a really good, underappreciated character actor. He's one of those guys, when he shows up, I am glad to see him. I think immediately he's like Shea Whigham is in this level with me, where these guys pop up and stuff, and I'm like, good to see you. You are going to make this better right away. But I think he was very much playing into the, like, there's the great Mask of the Red Death movie from the 1960s, early 70s. It's very mod. It is very camp. It's a Technicolor nightmare. and I think he was kind of playing in that vein, whereas other people, and I feel like Frank Langella must have been doing something much, much more dour, because some of the performances that I felt were out of place, I'm judging off. I love what Bruce Greenwood is doing. I love what Carla Gugino is doing. I love what Willa Fitzgerald is doing in the flashbacks. And I feel like they're all kind of on one page, and then other people are on this other page. And I'm like, I feel like maybe Frank Langella was just calibrated on a different frequency. And some of these characters only have one or two scenes in the 8 hours, in the 8 episodes with Roderick, their dad. And the rest of their performance is kind of off because they were responding initially to whatever Langella was giving them.
Maybe. We have no idea. Way of confirming whether anything you just said is accurate, but it's very possible. That is a huge
creative upheaval to go through mid-production.
Yes.
That I feel like there would probably be some dissonance. Also just being shut down for months.
Yeah, that's hard.
And then the conditions when they come back were hard. There's just a lot.
So logistical difficulties may have contributed to the final product, as always. But anyway, those are our overall thoughts on the fall of the House of Usher, and you're listening to the Decoding TV podcast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable, too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
All right, Sarah Mars, let's get to an episode by episode discussion of what's going on here. Let's start with episode one. So at this point, you should assume this conversation will spoil every episode. So do not listen.
Spoilers from here on out.
Yes, from here forward, we're going to spoil episode 8 and episode 1 and so forth. So like, just assume it's all spoiled from this point forward. All right. So spoilers for everything from the fall of the House of Usher. Let's begin. Episode 1. In this episode, we meet pharma billionaire Roderick Usher and his six detestable children, his twisted sister Madeline, and Verna, a mysterious woman with unknown connections to Roderick. By the way, she's called Verna in like all the materials we've read online. She's
very rarely
referred to as Verna in the show, if ever, although as Sarah Mars pointed out, Verna is an anagram for Raven. The family is on trial, prosecuted by C. Auguste Dupin, who alludes to an informant within the family. Meanwhile, Roderick's eldest three children have died, and he begins recounting his history to Dupin, including the time his mother died and came back to life to murder his father. This is like probably my least favorite episode of the whole show. You know, like it's just mostly set up, and I didn't find the history of his mom to be particularly interesting. And, you know, it was actually like one of those first episodes that I'm like, do I want to keep watching this? You know, so I didn't think it was particularly great or that there was anything interesting to call out about it, other than that they kind of start with the fact that like all the kids are dead and we're now going to learn how they die. Like, you know, that they're putting like their cards on the table right from the start. And I do think that that's worthwhile. Sarah Mars, anything worth mentioning about episode one, A Midnight Dreary?
It is my second least favorite episode of the series. There's one that I dislike more. I was like, it's so table setting.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I guess you have to be like, because the show is doing a lot. Like you said, it's very ambitious. It is doing a lot of things at once. So I guess you do have to have that episode where you're like, okay, here's all of the things. And then we can start. but this really feels like just sort of idling in neutral for 50 minutes.
Totally. Agreed completely. I'm trying to think if there's anything else worth bringing up about it. I mean, it sets up like who all the family members are, and like, you know, I did want to call out that, like Succession is a very easy thing to compare this to, but I think a better comparison is Knives Out. The tone of Knives Out and like how it portrays rich people and how it's like a little bit goofy, like that is a much better comparison than Succession.
I mean, the recency bias, Succession just ended last summer. Knives Out was 4 years ago. But also I think maybe the Succession stuff is mostly just the idea that there's this patriarch who is pitting his children against each other. I would say Knives Out is definitely a better touch point, though, just in terms of the humor. One thing Fall of the House of Usher does have is a lot of humor. Pretty dark humor. I think like Midnight Mass, for instance, not that there aren't moments of levity in that show, but that's like a very dark, that's very dark. It's very grim. It's very dark. Usher is not. There's like these terrible things are happening, but you are the one really good thing about the first episode is you are immediately given permission to hate almost all of the Ushers,
right,
root against them, and immediately start looking at the episode titles going, okay, who's going to die, which way, and how awful is it going to be?
Yeah.
And just actively like rooting for them to die.
Exactly. They don't seem particularly complicated, right?
No.
The other thing I think is interesting is like, as you've already pointed out, the way the show uses names is kind of notable. So we got Lenore. She's the grand, in The Raven, Lenore is, I believe, the love interest of the protagonist of the poem The Raven, right?
And she's the idealized love interest.
Right.
She's very much like Annabelle Lee. She's a very idealized figure of innocence and purity and goodness, which is very rare in Poe's work.
Yeah, but in the show, she is Roderick Usher's granddaughter, and she's a child, right?
She's a good kid.
Auguste Dupin is a detective that appears in several of Poe's stories. He's basically a DA or ADA here, right? Or a U.S. attorney, I think, actually.
In the older iteration played by Carl Lumley, he's an assistant U.S. attorney who's prosecuting the case against the Ushers.
Yeah,
Unlike the Sacklers, the Ushers are being hauled into court for the damage Ligadone has done.
Yeah.
And then in the flashbacks, he starts out as like an insurance investigator. So he's not a detective like he is in the stories, but he's still an investigator. He's still someone who is kind of unpicking some of this tangled web.
Right. And you also point out that Roderick and Madeline's mother is named Eliza, which is also the name of Poe's mother. So like it's kind of like fun little Easter eggs to to show you that
if you're a big Poe fan, if you're a Poe fan, there's a million. And I'm sure I missed them. Like there's so many that I'm like, I know I missed some.
All right. Episode 2, The Mask of the Red Death. In this episode, Prospero, Roderick's youngest son, holds a party. And Frederick's disaffected wife, Maury, seeks escape, both with disastrous consequences. In the past, young Roderick fails to convince his boss at Fortunato Pharmaceutical, Rufus Griswold, to invest in Ligodone.
I do really want to shout out, okay, Rufus Griswold, back in Poe's day, was a real person. He was a Po-fo, and he was a foe of Poe. And he wrote, under a pseudonym, but he wrote, like, the worst obituary. Like, just the meanest, most petty obituary when Poe died. It was just so, like, so of course they named this just asshole boss Rufus Griswold.
I thought the actor was awesome. I mean, you know, one of the things that that is true of this show, Michael Trucco, by the way, is the actor that plays Rufus Griswold. One of the things that's true of the show, a lot of monologues, Sarah Mars. A lot of monologuing. Like, you know, you go into Rufus Griswold's office and it's like, hey, I have this idea. Instead, you get like a 10-minute monologue about the meaning of work or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's fun to see actors, you know, tear into that stuff. But it is a lot for an 8-hour long show, you know. There's very few of them that are like bad monologues or anything like that. But there is a lot of telling and not showing in Mike Flanagan's work, I think. And I do think Fall of the House of Usher suffers a little bit more from that than some of his other work.
I think it was the epic monologues, I think, were the most eloquently rendered and cohesively fit into the show in Midnight Mass. I think that's part of what made Midnight Mass so good was you did have these huge monologues that very good actors were delivering. And it didn't actually feel distracting, whereas there are many instances in Usher where it's like, shut up.
Like, I think part of it, Sarah, is because of the fact that Midnight Mass takes place in a small town, right? Mm-hmm. Like on an island. And it makes sense that people there would spend lots of their time talking, right? Whereas Fall of the House of Usher takes place largely in corporations. And large, long monologues generally don't take place as much. I'm not saying they never happen, but like in corporations, it just doesn't feel like it's not a fit that makes as much sense because people have to get stuff done, you know? Like,
yeah, people are busy.
People are busy. Okay. But anyway, this episode was actually great because it was horrifying.
Well, let's go full spoiler. This is the episode. Episode one, I was like, oh. Yeah. I don't know. I like these actors. I like Mike Flanagan. I like Poe, but I don't know. Episode two is the moment where I was like, all right, however like schlocky this gets, I'm in. The rendering of The Mask of the Red Death, I thought this was one of the better adaptations of Poe in the series. So Roderick has two legitimate children, his two oldest, and then he has four illegitimate children. And the youngest of them is Prospero, which is the protagonist of The Mask of the Red Death story. And they call him Perry. And I think Perry, this actually kind of made me feel bad because I think he has arguably the worst death and is also probably the least offensive of the Usher children. He's only like 22 or 23. Like they specifically say like he's very young and he hasn't, and
he's an asshole, but he's like an asshole like any regular 23-year-old would be. Yeah, he's not like specifically, yes, he wants, yeah, go ahead.
He's not part of the corporate machine of Fortunato Pharmaceutical, which is the Usher company. He mostly just hasn't found his way. Like he's kind of aimless, like any 23-year-old would be, especially a rich one who doesn't have to work. He's struggling to find his identity. He's got a very powerful, charismatic father. He's got these older siblings who are established in various ways. He has not found his thing. And he also has sort of like, I feel there's a little bit of condemnation on the Zoomers because he has like, oh, I just want to be an influencer. Like his right. his ambition is just to be an influencer.
And it's like, how dare you, Gen Z? Yeah, how dare like, that be
like,
your
it's
ambition?
It's the worst thing in the world. And to me, it's like every time I meet a Zoomer who's like, I just want to be a YouTuber. I'm like, of course you do. The world sucks. Like,
yes, absolutely.
And you don't want to participate in it. And I get it.
Yeah.
It's Perry is truly, I think, like the least offensive of the siblings. And
right. But as you said, he gets the most horrifying death. And yeah, this is when the show really grabbed my attention because
it's
like,
bad.
Wow. I don't know that I've never seen anything like what they show before, but it's like, wow, that is horrifying and unique. And
the production design is like,
yeah, it looks spectacularly
awful.
Terrible. Like basically, so what happens in the show is, he accidentally unleashes all these toxic chemicals onto these horny party goers.
Yeah, he throws an unlicensed rave. Is there any other kind? At one of the Fortunato like derelict properties that is due to be condemned. There are, like many old buildings, there are water tanks on the roof that would be the source of the water in the building. If you turn the taps on, the water's coming from the tanks. And he decides to link them up, like to jerry-rig those water tanks to the sprinkler system in the building. And during the rave, at like the climactic moment, the water's going to come on and like, oh, everybody's going to be wet and horny and it's going to become an orgy. That's the plan. And I'm like, have you had sex? That's not like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. We're like, guys, the people, he's like, we're going to get all these celebrities there. And it's like, the people that you want at the party do not pay to go to those parties.
Yeah.
Right? Like you pay them to show up. Basically.
Just the idea that like, we're going to douse everybody with water. I'm like, this is a kid who I wanted to see Perry's bedroom because I'm like, there will be a Blade poster on the wall.
Yeah.
He is just thinking about the blood rave in Blade.
his bed is shaped like a race car. Anyway. Yeah.
But
so,
it's acid.
Like this stuff that burn and like all these people basically melt. They basically melt. It's horrifying.
And I have like a, it's on my unreal, slightly unreal. I mean, people do get acid thrown on them. That happens. But I have like an unrealistic fear of like acid. Like just to me, that was personally horrifying.
Wow.
I'm
wow.
Just
very
like,
triggering for Sarah Marr specifically.
I was just like, this is a really terrible, terrible thing. And Maury, Frederick, the eldest Usher sibling, his wife is there. She has a chance to leave. Verna, Carla Gugino's mysterious character, Raven, whatever you want to call her. She warns her. She warns the waitstaff and she warns Maury to leave. And Maury doesn't. So she is injured. She's the only survivor. And it's very, very grim for her. She is like 100% acid burn.
Yeah.
And that is not a Hacker's reference. It is a terrible thing that happens.
Wow.
But it is just like the worst, just the buildup and just knowing like, okay, his name is Prospero. The episode is called The Mask of the Red Death. He's going to have this party for this exclusive group of celebrities and influencers. It's like, this is going to go really horribly awry. How was this going to go awry? And for some reason, the water tanks just didn't connect until the moment that people started screaming. And then you're like, oh my God, that's because they've been dropping all the hints that the building is condemned and Frederick was supposed to have it demolished years ago and didn't. And Dupin is looking into EPA violations that the company has not been properly disposing of chemicals. And it turns out Roderick was warehousing toxic chemicals in those water tanks to avoid regulations and fines. And which is a great Poe connection of hubris and regret and things that like you make one decision years ago. And then in the present day, it has this disastrous consequence. That's great Poe stuff. But I just felt like, oh, Perry doesn't deserve this. Like, this is really... And the overhead shot of the acid-melted crowd is truly one of the most gruesome things that I have seen outside of, like, Japanese horror in recent memory.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really bad.
It's good stuff. It's good stuff when it comes to horror stuff, horror filmmaking. So... Anyway, that's when, you know, the show had my attention. I'm like, okay, show, you have my attention now. Episode 2, The Mask of the Red Death. In episode 3, Roderick's daughter, Camille, unwisely indulges in her own investigation. Leo believes he has killed a cat, and Victorine's heart mesh device, we learn, isn't really working. And this is the episode where I think Camille dies because she's like poking around in the Rue investigative laboratory, right?
Yeah, so murder in the Rue Morgue is set in France, and Rue Morgue is the street where the house is, where the murder occurs. Here, it has been rebranded as a research facility for Fortunato Pharmaceutical. It's called, and the nickname is Rue Morgue because it's animal testing and all the animals that are dying. Victorine is the eldest illegitimate child, and she is trying to create kind of a pacemaker. They call it a mesh, but it's like a techie pacemaker that will keep your heart going and give you all of this data about your health. It's not working. Camille, who is named after one of the victims in the short story, she goes to the research facility to see what's going on with Victorine and Camille have like a whole beef. They don't like each other. And she goes to see what's going on with Victorine's device and the testing and the rumors about all of the monkeys, because Victorine has been lying to Roderick about the success of the device and how the testing is going. And Camille gets wind of this. She's like the PR maven of the family. And she has these little assistants that she calls Tina and Toby. And I think they're both veterans of the Midnight Club. Definitely the blonde kid is. Toby definitely is. She goes to Rue Morgue to see about the animal testing. And this is the episode I hated. I disliked this episode so much.
Tell me why that is, Sarah.
It was so brutal, coming off the Mask of the Red Death, which was so gross and genuinely horrifying. And I thought a pretty good, solid adaptation of that story in terms of translating it into the modern world. Murder in the Rue Morgue is... if it's not the first locked door mystery, it is certainly one of the earliest and the most popular. The whole deal with the murder in the Rue Morgue is that it is a locked door mystery with a monkey involvement. And when we did our Justified City Primeval recaps, I talked about narrative rules and that there are rules that dictate how stories work. The two rules of Murder in the Rue Morgue is that it is a locked door mystery with monkey involvement. And this series does not even try to make it a locked door mystery.
Right. I mean, I think...
they don't even try.
I think we just had very different expectations, Sarah Mars. I was like, things are changed so dramatically. Like, we're in modern day. He's adapting all... he's combining stories, like... he's combining Fall of the House of Usher with like...
it is rumor. Arguably the most famous Poe story.
Sure, sure. I'm not disagreeing that it's a bad adaptation. I'm just saying after episodes 1 and 2, I did not expect a faithful adaptation. You know what I'm saying? Like,
I mean, not even so, faithful. It's it's a locked door mystery.
You're saying it's not... you're upset that it's not even the same concept. Which
they don't even try. I feel like with the other stories, they really tried to update. Like Mask of the Red Death in its original form, in the Poe story, is set during the Black Death, during the plague, in the medieval times in Europe. And the idea is that it's a bunch of rich people isolating themselves from the plague, and the plague finds a way in. And this, they turn it into this exclusive rave, and then, you know, death finds a way in. And I thought, it's pretty clever. Like, the way they updated, I don't think Perry deserved that. Bad death, bad way to go for Perry, who just kind of seemed like a little bit of a 23-year-old asshole, and not worse than that. But I thought they made some really smart decisions about how to update that and translate the medieval setting to the modern setting and all of these things. This, I'm like, they didn't even try.
All right.
Did not even make an attempt.
Fair enough. Did not bother me at all. But I will say that, you know, the episode I thought was just fine. You know, she breaks in, and then one of the primates murders her brutally. We get a little bit more sense of like Carla Gugino's powers and like what her game is a little bit, that's about it. You know,
I do appreciate I did one thing I will give this is Kate Siegel's episode. She plays Camille. She is my Flanagan's wife, and I do feel like she has the inside track on how to deliver performances in his worlds. I feel like she was pretty keyed in, and I really liked her performance as Camille, who was just awful, like just a really terrible terrible person. I did like very much, so when they go into the animal testing room and she's sort of looking for evidence that this heart device isn't working, all you really see, because it's mostly Carla Gugino talking to her in the scene, yeah. all you really see is a single shot of one like little like monkey finger opening a latch.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's just Carla Gugino until the moment Camille kind of confronts Verna. And then you see one spectacularly rendered shot of a super pissed off, disfigured yeah. chimpanzee. And that's it. And I was like, I love that they didn't waste their budget on trying to stage the attack. Because right. one, you are not going to do it better than Nope.
mm-hmm.
And two, instead of trying to have the actual violence, just showing us the exquisitely rendered ape and how his angry expression, that's all we need. That's all we need. I thought it was really well done. I just hated that they didn't even try to make it a locked door mystery.
Yeah, I agree completely with you. And I also like how in this episode, the last episode, and also the next episode, the nature of Carla Gugino's character's powers are unclear.
Can we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, let's do the next episode and then let's talk about it. But I think suffice to say, you don't know what she's capable of, or if these people are like hallucinating her, or whatever's going on at this stage in the show. Also, in these couple episodes, we also kind of learn a little bit more about the Usher's sexual proclivities and how
they're
like,
all fucked up.
let's not kink shame.
That's but like, true. But no, it's a real thing.
Here's what I can say is they are all making people do things against their will or preference, right? Like that is the thing that's happening. Which
there's
is bad, right?
There's a real streak of it is on the one hand, it's very inclusive. Camille has her two little assistants that she is forcing into a sexual relationship. That's not great, but it implies that she is bi, and Leo Napoleon, the Rahul Kohli's character, is implied to be like pan. So it's very inclusive. Everybody's like just sort of into everything. Everybody's down for it all, which is great, whatever.
But they're also like not nice people. Like they're forcing these people,
they're taking advantage.
Yeah, they're taking advantage, which is that so that we can shame for sure. So
celebrate the inclusivity only to a point.
Yeah,
because this 100%. Is not positive representation. But I do think, like, I think Mike Flanagan, I would love, I have, if I could interview him, I have only one question, which is, which weird billionaire did you meet? Because there is some stuff in here. I have had the misfortune in my life to meet some very high net worth individuals, and they are all into weird sex stuff. It's truly like, I tried to have a conversation once with the scion of one of these families who was slightly not into weird sex stuff yet. I was like, why are they all into weird sex stuff? And his theory coming from inside the house was, when you can buy anything, when you can go anywhere, when you can do and have whatever you want, weird sex stuff is all that's left. And okay. So they're all into weird sex stuff, and they're all into ancient Egypt. They are all illegally collecting illegal ancient Egyptian artifacts. That is not made all up right. for the show. They are doing that.
All right. Moving on to episode 4, The Black Cat. In this episode, Roderick reveals his diagnosis, and Leo adopts a cat, and it goes badly. In the past, Madeline plots with while Rufus Griswold frames Roderick for irregularities at Fortunato, and then Roderick meets Auguste Dupin for the first time. I thought this episode was pretty solid, and I like, you know, how the black cat thing plays out. I like that it's like, and again, you're questioning, could what's his name, Leo? Is it because there's a supernatural intervention, or is it because he's like hopped out beyond his mind on drugs? Like you don't know what it is. And the idea of like buying a cat to replace the one he lost. And then, by the way, later seeing like a picture of the cat, it wasn't a cat at all that, you know, Carla was holding. That was an amazing moment. Yeah.
This, like, so this like, was actually, my second favorite episode of the whole series.
Yeah.
And I think
this
is one of the better adaptations of Poe, just in terms of taking the story of the black cat. And by the way, if you're listening to this and for some reason you haven't seen the series yet, like just lots of graphic animal cruelty in this episode. And it's a CGI cat. They're not harming a real cat, but it's graphic and it's hard. And I own a black cat. And it was, I had, there was a couple points in this episode where I just had to pause and like, just give myself like a minute. Cause I was like, this is really tough.
Yeah. But the idea of like Leo taking this Mjolnir Thor hammer and just completely like wrecking his house. It's an amazing idea and visual, you know.
Leo is played by Rahul Kohli, who I love to watch him as an actor. He's great. And he plays kind of, he's like a video game person.
You don't really see it. He's like a Twitch streamer
and maybe he has used some of his inheritance money to fund video games. Like they kind of say at some point he's passing himself off as like a game creator and his siblings are like, you just give him money. Like you have created nothing. And that is actually a theme for all of the Ushers, is that they create nothing. They contribute nothing. Like Perry is trying to get his dad to give him money to invest in like a whiskey or a brandy or an alcohol brand, and it's not anything he has created. It's something he found that he wants money to put into. And Roderick did not create Ligodone. He found it and wants Rufus Griswold to put money into it. He believes it has potential. And Napoleon, Leo, is a video game guy, but he doesn't create the games. He's not writing the games or doing the art or anything. He's just like a Twitch streamer who maybe promotes games. It's not super clear that none of them create. None of them contribute. Which again, I'm like, Mike Flanagan, which weird billionaire did you meet? Because those people, again, I have met a few, they will tell you they are the masterminds. And they never are. Mm. Steve Jobs was not an engineer. He was probably the 20th century's greatest ad man, in the same way that Thomas Edison did not invent the light bulb. He was probably the 19th century's greatest ad man.
Mm-hmm.
That is a consistent theme. Elon Musk has invented nothing. He just buys companies who pay him to go away. Like, and it's really pronounced in the House of Usher, which is why I think Mike Flanagan wanted to make a series about punishing a billionaire for societal ills. Right. And that is great. And it just doesn't quite graft onto the post of super well, except in this episode, because at this point, Napoleon has lost two of his siblings. And he's paranoid. He's also a drug addict, so he's out of his mind on coke, which is making his paranoia worse. He hates his boyfriend's cat. He thinks he killed the cat in a drug-fueled outrage. And everything that happens to Napoleon, I think it's really well rendered, where to his boyfriend, he appears to be in a downward grief-fueled spire that is enhanced and made worse by the cocaine. Whereas we are privy to, no, something's going on. There's this weird lady who keeps showing up and talking weird to all these siblings. And that cat is fucking weird. But yeah, he has all these like Marvel props. He's like collected like Marvel movie props. And he uses Thor's hammer to destroy his apartment.
Yeah.
This was a fun episode. I mean, the animal cruelty aside, this was a fun episode.
This is a good one. Also, thanks, Sarah Morris, for pissing off three separate rabid fan bases at once with that description just now. Steve Jobs fans, Elon Musk fans, and also Edison fans. The three largest, most rabid fan bases on the internet. All right. Anyway, episode 5, The Telltale Heart. In this episode, Victorine is hearing things. Dupin tells the truth, and Arthur Pym, the Usher's creepy fixer, makes a possible connection to Carlo Gugino's character. In the past, Rufus Griswold reveals he knows the truth about the Usher's parentage, and they join forces with Dupin to take down Griswold and Fortunato. Let's save all of the past stuff and how that all coincides for the final episode. I'll just say, in terms of this kill, I thought this was awesome, because the Telltale Heart is a very well-regarded, like, well-known story. And then you start hearing the heart, like, she starts hearing the heart beating, and it's like, it doesn't sound like a heart. It sounds like something weird. It sounds like something mechanical, like some machinery. And it's like, that's a weird interpretation of the heart. And then you find out it's this heart valve that she's trying to make that she had like installed on her dead partner.
The body horror in this episode is really good.
Yeah.
If you're a body horror person, this is a good episode of body horror.
It's great the way like the reveal happens when she's dead and like the performance of like she's crazed and like doesn't really understand the implications of what she's done. Everything I thought was pretty awesome. I enjoyed this one quite a bit. Sarah Mars, any thoughts on The Telltale Heart?
Yeah, I also like this, and I'm trying to find the actress's name. She was in the Haunting of Bly Manor. She is Tania Miller, plays Victorine, yeah, who is the surgeon daughter. She's one of the illegitimate children. She's trying to make this device. The device is what we hear ticking throughout the episode. I thought it was really, all of that stuff was really well done. Again, just spectacularly gross body horror. And then I really love Roderick Usher's reaction to, and this is where I feel like Bruce Greenwood was interpreting this as like kind of a schlocky Vincent Price thing, is he's very much just like, he takes a look at what Victorine has done and just goes, well, he has like no reaction except to say, we have to clean this mess up. Which I thought was
really,
kind of,
that was not my interpretation of that at all.
Like, I think he had a big reaction to it.
I think you and I just had completely different reads on Bruce Greenwood's performance. Cause like, my interpretation is Bruce Greenwood was the word schlock does not even come to mind when it comes to Bruce Greenwood. I thought he brought a lot of dignity to this character. And when he sees Victorine's dead partner, he is like horrified and frightened for his own life. Like those are my emotions that I read coming
off
of
them. I was getting a lot. I will say like the schlockiness of his performance, I think comes in the last episode. We'll get there.
Okay. Fair. Yeah. Fair. But like but the whole time
he is relying on Victorine. So Roderick has been diagnosed with codicil, which is a long and complicated medical name, but basically it's a stroke disorder. And in the first episode, we actually see him collapse and perhaps have an hallucination brought on by an ischemic stroke. And he is deteriorating rapidly. And one thing that is going to happen to him is one of Codicil's symptoms is rapid onset dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And so he knows he's losing his mind. And so some of what's happening in the show is like, is it real or is Roderick hallucinating? Is he starting to overlap time because this dementia is starting to eat away at his memories? He is in a race against the clock and he is relying on, I never quite understood the connection between like basically a pacemaker and dementia. I was like, I don't quite get it, but he is relying on Victorine to have this device to somehow save him. And so when he sees that she has killed her partner, who was the doctor leading the study to get this heart mesh device, you know, into human trials, and flayed her open and pinned the device into her chest cavity. And it's the device ticking and the woman is not alive. She is not alive. It's very Silence of the Lambs. I thought like that splaying of the body. I was like, this is like big time. The props team had like a lot of fun on this show.
Yeah.
But I kind of saw like Roderick. Yeah, there's a moment where he's looking at Victorine of like, oh, she doesn't realize what she's done. Cause Victorine panicked in a moment of panic. She threw a bookend and killed her partner. And she is just in pure panic mode from then on out. And so he is having a moment of connecting. Victorine killed her. Does not compute that she has killed her. Victorine is in la-la land. She has cracked. The strain, the pressure has just cracked her. And also the disappointment that the device is a failure. This is the moment where two things are revealed to Roderick. Victorine killed her partner. And the heart mesh that he was relying on as a ticket out of his, you know, terrible diagnosis doesn't work. And what I was getting from Bruce Greenwood in that moment is that disappointment is overshadowing the feeling of like, my daughter killed a woman who I knew and cared about. You know, like it's that disappointment of like, oh, and then he calls Arthur Pym to clean it up.
Mm. Interesting. I think it's just interesting that we both read the Bruce Greenwood thing very differently.
I'm just not giving Roderick Usher a lot of grace. Like, yeah. I think you're giving him a lot of grace. Like, he's got this dignity. And I'm like, he's a fucking murderer.
I'm just talking about...
psychologically tortured his children.
I'm just talking about the performance. Like, I think he's playing Roderick Usher like Brian Cox played Logan Roy. That's my feeling.
I think he has more gravitas.
Sure.
He's playing Roderick Usher as a very eminent person. But then there's always these little pokey pokies of like, oh no, this woman is dead. Fuck, the heart device doesn't work.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that. In any case, I thought this was a good episode and a good reveal.
Tania Miller is really good. Really good.
Yeah, agreed. All right, episode 6. Tamerlane is losing it. Frederick's losing it. Madeline's losing it. Roderick's losing it. And Pin makes a startling discovery. And in the past, Dupin and Roderick continue investigating Fortunato on their own. This is the episode where the Gold Bug fitness program is revealed to the world. And then this is actually one of the cooler kills in the show.
Oh,
was like with all the glass and the slow motion.
Very cinematic.
Really good stuff. So I dug all that. I think this is a good time to now talk about the Carlo Gugino character, because basically, as the show goes on, Carlo Gugino intervenes more and more in the deaths. Like the first few deaths, it's like, oh, those could have happened without any supernatural assistance at all, right? And then like as time goes on, it's like, oh, she is just actively displaying supernatural abilities now explicitly. And I gotta say, I was a little bit disappointed by that. I wish they had kind of kept it as though like it could have been either way the whole time. Whereas like towards the end, it really feels like there's supernatural intervention for a lot of these deaths, including like Mary McDonald's character trying to grab her and then her just vanishing. Like that's just like, okay, like.
Yeah, at that point, she's fully magic.
She's a magic person, you know?
So, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit.
Sure, I think
from the beginning, from Prospero, the first death we see, it's clear that she has otherworldly abilities. She is a supernatural figure. But within the world of the show, those first few deaths must read to the public as totally and tragically coincidental.
Mm-hmm.
Prospero threw this party, didn't know what was in the water tanks. It's a horrible accident. Camille was investigating and an angry science monkey killed her. And Napoleon is high on coke and appears to die by suicide. That's what his death looks like to Julius, his boyfriend, and everybody else, is that he died by suicide, falling off his balcony. Or maybe not even suicide. Maybe he was just high and he fell off the balcony. But it just seems like he fell. That's what happened. We see Carlo Gugino warning everyone to leave the party. We see her, and I'm going to call her Verna because that's how she's referenced in show notes. We see Verna talking to, we see in the sequence of events in Rue Morgue is we see the monkey open the cage. We see Verna talking to Camille in the laboratory room that is housing all of the monkeys. We see her in like a quick smash, like we see her go. It's not a misty, wispy thing. It's like I think Camille takes a picture with her camera. And what the picture reveals as we're seeing Carlo Gugino, what is revealed on the phone camera is the angry ape. So it's clear that like, oh, she's like a supernatural person. She's popping up in all these places. And then in the Black Cat episode, the cat that she gives Napoleon is a rat. And also we see when he has the dupe Pluto, he'll see its eyes flashing in the dark, which if you've ever had a cat, their eyes refract light. So at night, especially if you have a black cat like I do, often all you see are their little glowing eyes in the dark. And he sees that. And then we see that same thing in her eyes. And she takes on the injuries of the cat as mm-hmm. Leo is trying to kill this cat. He gouges its eye out and we see her with her eye gouged out. It is clear to us, the audience, she is a supernatural figure. But within the world of the show, those deaths must just look like tragic coincidence. a terrible accident, another terrible accident, a, you know, unfortunate co-bender, maybe suicide situation. So to them, it all seems coincidental and random until Pym, Arthur Pym, played by Mark Hamill, who is also sort of in the, I'm doing a weird voice, I'm playing this very like sketchy right. character in a very sketchy way. He starts to connect the dots that she's present. She was at the party. She met Camille. She was the security guard who let her into the laboratory. She was the worker at the Humane Society where Leo gets the second cat. You know, and he's connecting the dots between the kids. And at first he thinks maybe she's another illegitimate usher.
Yeah.
And she's angry because she was never recognized or whatever. Like maybe she's an angry, illegitimate usher. And then he starts to find pictures of her in the past. And this is actually where the show lost it for me a little
bit. Yes, absolutely.
I was like, I don't need her standing right. next to like Clinton and Kennedy and all these ill-fated people and evil people. They show her with Trump. And I'm like, I don't need any of that.
I don't think you need this whole entire subplot of like trying to identify her from the security camera footage. Like she's not in the security camera footage, you know, like just she's freaking supernatural. You don't need like the whole point of all that from my perspective was just so she and Pym could have the meeting at the end.
Yes.
And that was a cool meeting. I really like that. That was
which
like a
you
nice
still could have had.
You still could have had. You don't need that entire subplot of them. Yeah, I agree.
My problem with Rue Morgue, it's not a locked door mystery. Taking her out of that security footage, if all they see on the security camera is Camille walking into the building and
yes.
somehow, and there's no guard, that is an empty station, and Camille, who should not have an access card, somehow accesses that room and they do not know how, now it's a locked door mystery.
Okay, all right.
I mean, it's that simple. I did not like, I liked a lot of the stuff where they were doing this thing. I was like, we, the audience, are privy to the fact that this woman is appearing to these children and then they're all dying and she is somehow involved to the world of the show, to the other ushers and the public and Dupin and everything. Is it just seems like a horrible series of accidents and coincidences. I actually thought Verna was, by the end of the series, I was kind of thinking like, is she the Morrigan? The Celtic goddess of death, war, and fate. Mm-hmm. One of whom signs is ravens.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she sort of displays Morrigan-like ability and thought process and the way the Morrigan functioned in that mythology. She seems to kind of be upholding some of that.
Well, here is my case for why I don't like it. Is the whole time, like one of the central questions that Roderick and Madeline ask themselves, it's like, was it all in our head? Like, was it a real deal that we made with the devil, or was it all in our head? And that is like a haunting mystery, and the show could have kept that ambiguity until the end.
Yes.
It chose not to and like made clear that Carlo Gugino is actually a supernatural force intervening on things, but it could have easily just not done that. It could have easily just had her, like all the deaths could have happened coincidentally, and maybe Carla Gugino is there, but maybe she's not actually a real supernatural force. Maybe she's just like, I don't know, a goat.
Or
like,
maybe she is a supernatural force and you just never answer that question for the characters in the show. Maybe
exactly.
Madeline and Roderick never really know.
Exactly.
And that's
right.
Fine.
I agree. I agree completely. So anyway, so episode 6, the gold bug. Oh, I did think it was like really horrifying. Like the idea of being up there on stage and things are going wrong. That's like a very mortifying idea. People, you know, public speaking is one of America's most feared things. And so the idea of like going up there and it going all wrong, it's horrifying. I will say the speech and the whole setup felt pretty underwhelming. For a presentation of this caliber, like
it
felt like they were
like,
really limited budget wise.
It looked like the end of Megan, the horror movie about the dancing murder.
I would argue the end of Megan was more ambitious than this.
yeah, like this looked like they're starting to run out of budget.
It looked like basically kind of like they did this announcement in like a hotel ballroom, pretty much. Actually, not something smaller than a hotel ballroom, basically like a conference.
Like
room,
a conference room. They clearly spent the money on the death scene.
Right.
That's where the money went, was the death
right,
scene.
Which is a good allocation, but it was like, oh, that's kind of, yeah, anyway.
But the idea that one of the ushers would launch her goop-style wellness grift from ballroom C at the Airport Hyatt was like, what is happening?
I agree. It was shockingly cheap looking given how much buildup there had been for this and everything else that we've seen in the show. But the death scene really was incredible. The glass and the falling and the slow motion, amazing.
And they horrible. Spent the money it was right another way. One to think about, like, oh, that's a really bad way to go. These and are I all love, bad I love deaths. The way he, I love the way he used like deaths.
I love the way he used like slow motion and then like the slow motion and then it like smash cuts to like regular motion.
Yeah.
It was all really well done. So nice kill, but a weird, okay episode otherwise. All right. The Pit and the Pendulum, in which we ask the question, is Frederick the worst usher? Meanwhile, Madeline tries to save herself, but Carla Gugino's character has other plans and Juno stands up for herself. In the past, Madeline envisions Fortunato remade as a tech company while Roderick commits a betrayal. Let's talk about a comment you made earlier in this podcast about how some of the past and present performances didn't necessarily line up. Mary McDonnell is an incredibly talented actor, and her modern day performance as Madeline, I thought, was pretty disastrous. Like, I thought it was just really over the top and didn't fit with the rest of the show. And more importantly, didn't fit with younger Madeline, who I thought was a really amazing character. And it's like, oh, I want to see where this character goes. Like, what happens with this character?
Younger Madeline is played by Willa Fitzgerald. And I do want to shout out, it's a little bit, the past sequences are a little bit a Reacher reunion because it's Willa Fitzgerald and Malcolm Goodwin as young Dupin, and they were both in Reacher. Anyway, she is playing Madeline in a way that by this episode, I was like, Madeline of 1979 would straight up smother Roderick in his sleep. Like, she would not be trying to save him or his children. She would not be trying to, I don't know. There was a whole lot of, like, she doesn't turn on Roderick until, like, very late in proceedings. And I'm like, no, I feel like she would have been trying to poison Roderick this whole time.
The performance doesn't match. The character is not believable. Like,
there's a big disconnect. Unfortunately, the Madeline character, which undermines a lot of the late stage drama in these last couple episodes.
Also, I think Madeline has a very bizarre, undefined accent in the first couple episodes that is then pretty much dropped by the end, as far as I can tell.
I don't know if that was Mary McDonnell. Like,
why would she have an accent and then her brother doesn't? It just doesn't make any sense. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah.
The idea of that's another thing is like Henry Thomas, very talented actor. I thought he was awesome in Haunting of Hill House. I thought he was great in Dr. Sleep. But I did not enjoy his performance in this show. Like, it was.
I loved it.
he was great towards the end when he like was getting super evil. But the entire show, he's basically like Roman Roy from Succession, but with no redeeming qualities whatsoever. Right? Like, it's
he's the worst usher.
But that's like. That might be compelling for like a movie, but like to watch like 8 episodes of that or 7 episodes.
Many in the previous episodes? How much is he really in? I mean, you're not really, he's not the focal point until this episode. I think, he's terrible. His little terrible ponytail is the immediate clue that he's the worst. he is married to Maury, who seems pretty normal. And they have Lenore, who is actually genuinely a good kid. Like, Lenore is on the ball. She is sharp. Roderick at one point describes her as the best of us. Unquestionably, yes. Mm-hmm. And Frederick is awful. And he has a fucking bowling alley in his living room. It's just like every awful rich guy trope is in him. And I think Henry Thomas was having a ball playing all of that. And then playing the psychological devolution, because Maury was at the sex rave. She was at the acid sex rave. And had told him she was going to meet friends for dinner. So he thought he was so in love. He's a total wife guy. Thought he had something none of his siblings did, which was a good, stable relationship. even something his father didn't have. It's like his marriage to Maury is the one thing none of the other Ushers have. And then it's all blown up in the second episode when Maury is discovered at the sex rave. Mm-hmm. And then he's like, well, why was she there? Was she cheating on me? Blah, blah, blah. And he just devolves down.
Yeah. His descent into madness I found to be very compelling, but the idea that he had basically zero redeeming qualities, it's tough to watch a show that has a character like that. And you can bring out the kind of likability or charisma via the performance, even if it's not in the script. And I don't think he really brought that. That said, the idea of him being like a caretaker of his wife and like subjecting her to physical abuse and torture is genuinely upsetting and really well brought out in the show. His death scene with the pendulum and all that stuff, it's whatever. Like, it's cool to see a building fall apart from the inside. That was like a cool visual effect. But
don't think that was a visual effect. I think they demolished something.
Well,
be a visual effect. It wasn't a computer effect. I think they really demolished.
Right. But I mean, showing him in there is a visual effect. Like showing the POV of someone who's in there, So that was really cool. But otherwise, it's like I've seen, more gruesome kills in the Saw movies, which are not nearly as good as this show. So I thought this episode was only okay. Any other thoughts on episode 7, The Pit and the Pendulum?
No.
All right. Let's get to the final episode. And now, everything can be brought together. We can talk about every other remaining topic, right? So Pym has an encounter with Carla Gugino's character, and he's like, he declines to make a deal with her. She tries to make a deal with him, but tries to get him to do more evil things if he will. And in exchange, she'll make sure he doesn't go to prison, but he declines. He's like, I'll take my chances. A great scene, I thought, between two equally evil people.
Well, is she evil though? That's the thing. That's why I'm like, is she the Morrigan? Because people want to, she's a death goddess. She's the goddess of war. People want to think of her as an evil, bad entity, but death is inevitable. Fate is inescapable. You could argue war is in human nature. The Morrigan is just the worst of human impulse. And I don't think Verna is not making them do these things. She's there. She's maybe arguably facilitating, but she doesn't give Prospero the idea for the rave and the water tanks. She doesn't she tries to get Leo to not adopt the cat.
This is my objection, is by the end, she is actively intervening, with the medication, right? With what's his name?
Yeah. I think, with
Frederick,
she's telling him to put.
She's telling, right. And that's.
Yeah.
But I agree. Then also with when she kills Lenore, she seems to be a little broken up about it, right?
She's very, very
right.
Sad.
So it's like, yeah. So that's that is definitely sort of points in your book.
But I would say too, the Ushers that she offers an out are notably Perry and Leo, who are going to die because that's the deal that she made.
Right.
Is the deal that Roderick and Madeline struck on New Year's Eve 1980 was they would get away with all of their terrible crimes, up and including future crimes, which I think is how Flanagan is processing in the real world. There is no justice for people like the Sacklers. And it's like, well, they had to have made a deal with the devil to just get away with everything. Mm-hmm. But the cost is, well, everybody hates them. And in this world, they've made this deal and their fate is inescapable. And their fate is, she told them, all of your bloodline will die before you and then you will die. You will get away with what you have just done. You will get away with whatever you do in future, which is why Dupin can never pin anything on Roderick. And yet, someday your fate will come due. And when she meets with Lenore, she is very sad. And she says, did they not understand what bloodline meant? Because
right.
Now Lenore is part of the curse. And she has to die. Maury can live and will. She tells Lenore everything good your mother is going to do. She will recover and she will do good things. And it's because of you. But Lenore is an usher. She's in the bloodline. She has to die. Fortunately, she gets a peaceful, painless death.
Right, right. I mean, I think Carla Gugino's character is amused most of the time. And also, Sarah Mars, when she made that deal, I'm just going to put this out there. She didn't include all the relevant details, okay?
She said, your bloodline will die.
No, but she didn't say they're going to die horrifyingly painful deaths. And maybe, do you think maybe she said that, that would have been, that might have shaped their decision making a little bit, I think.
I don't think past Madeline would have given a shit.
if you told me the same deal and also like in one scenario, everyone's going to die peacefully surrounded by loved ones. And in the other scenario, they'll all die horribly painful deaths in grotesque fashion. That might change how I approach that deal. I'm just going
to
put that out there.
I do think, again, she tries to give Perry and Perry and Leo are cursed. They're going to die. But she tries to give them an out from the terrible death. And you wonder if either of them had taken her up on it, would Leo have just snorted some coke, gone to bed and died overdose? And it just would have been, he went to sleep and he never woke up and it was painless. And Perry, she also seemed quite sad about the fact that Perry, because again, he's young and he really hasn't done anything, but he's an usher, so he's got to die. And she does kind of, when they're in the bedroom together, she kind of tries to give him like, we can leave. You know, she tries to give him that out.
Fair point. I think you've made your case, and I think I respect it that like maybe Carla Gugino's character is not evil. Let's talk about...
She's only evil in the way that death is evil.
How did the stuff in the past work for you? I thought it was pretty good, but it was drawn out way too much. Like, what happens with the past stuff is you as the audience member, you get ahead of the storytelling, right? Like, you already, I don't know about you, but I kind of already predicted it's going to be Cask of Amontillado. He's put his boss behind the wall. And so then by the time we get to episode 8, we already know what's going to happen. Like, yeah. I don't know if I was not surprised by that in the
least. They were not seeding it as a surprise because Roderick keeps going to the basement and staring at the wall. Right. And he hears a mysterious jingle and it's like, it's the Cask of Amontillado.
Right. Which is fine, but like, not necessarily for 8 hours, right? Like it's fine if it's like 3 hours, then it's like, oh, okay. No, but it's like, okay, by the time we get to this big climactic moment, we already know how it's all going to play out. And so it does sap a little bit of the suspense from it.
I kind of almost thought they should have shifted the order of the past scenes so that we start at the end and work back to the front, like work back to the beginning, like start with New Year's Eve, 1980, where they make the deal with Verna and then work back to how did they arrive at that moment? Instead of starting with them as children and their dad is the founder of Fortunato, but they're illegitimate and he won't acknowledge them and their mom is bonkers and then she dies and then she's alive and then she kills their dad and then she's dead again and they're weird.
Instead, the path they chose is to make it a big kind of reveal, but like the problem is that the reveal has been sapped of all its power by that point. And if they had optimized for something that wasn't shocking twist, if they had optimized for, we're showing the parallelism between or the tragic nature of starting so doe-eyed and bushy-tailed and then like the downfall from the, you know, like if they had structured it a different way, it might have been a little bit more impactful.
Well, and it's also undercut by the fact that those younger character performances just don't match what the older actors are doing, most especially in the case of Madeline. But Zach Guilford plays the young Roderick, and I didn't think he particularly matched what Bruce Greenwood was doing. I really didn't buy that Willa Fitzgerald's young Madeline grows up into Mary McDonald's Madeline. I also kind of didn't buy that Zach Guilford grew up into Bruce Greenwood. I'm like, there's just a big disconnect. And they probably would have worked better and been more effective if I was seeing some of what I'm getting from the older actors in the younger performances. But like younger Madeline, again, like I just think she would have smothered Roderick in his sleep. And she also, like, I can't imagine that Madeline taking a side role at Fortunato, like, and being okay with it. Like, I could.
Right.
I was like, wait, is she supposed to be? The more we learn about young Madeline, and I'm like, wait, but in the current timeline, Madeline and Roderick are still close. They're still copacetic. Like, she's doing her tech thing. He doesn't seem to have a problem with it. She's like, is she the COO or something of the company? She right. has a role. And I was like, I don't think younger Madeline would have been cool with being sidelined.
Well, the whole proposition is like, you'll never need to listen to another man ever again. And it's like,
but she does. Her
but
brother.
Your job is, you got to listen to your brother. You know, like, it yeah. doesn't, it's a disappointing ending and sort of adult life for Madeline. Also, like, the whole tech company, the algorithm, completely half-baked as a plot line.
It's,
and like,
literally just so they can have the Nevermore.
The
text
Nevermore.
From
and it's like,
that's
okay.
It. That's
yeah.
it.
And so that's what I'm talking about like, that was like one subplot too many. You didn't need to have a little bit of Black Mirror in your show. There's already enough strong elements to it. So yeah, like there's certain elements of the show that are pretty disappointing, but there's also a lot of really amazing elements. Like, all the kills, or most of the kills, are really great. I love Bruce Greenwood, and you know, many of the actors do a good job as well. So any other thoughts on how this ended? I thought, like, Bruce Greenwood's character betraying Madeline at the end, you know, that was kind of effective. When she comes up and has the rocks in her eyes and starts choking him, that seemed a little bit goofy.
Well, that's where it gets into schlock. And yeah, it's very like Vincent Price Halloween special 1963.
That I will completely agree with you on. Right?
But it's also, I mean, there is a Poe story. I think it's something the mummy said, or words from a mummy. It's mummies in the title. But it's also, again, like, real rich people are super hung up on the pharaohs. So... I was like, this fits. But I thought that moment was fun in its schlockiness. It just did not fit the tone, like you said at the beginning, it didn't fit the tone of the rest of the show. It came out tonally, that came out of nowhere.
I mean, until the end, I was guessing what the tone of the show was. You know, I didn't have a good handle on what the tone of the show was.
Very up and down.
I liked
the little bit at the end with Verna in the cemetery and all of the ushers. And I found myself thinking, what does this look like to the public? Because Dupin mentions, he goes to the graves, he's talking to dead Roderick, and he mentions that he is retired. He did not get to prosecute his case, that all of the ushers being dead has basically killed his case. So, sort of like real life, they were never really prosecuted for Ligodone. And I did have this kind of moment, though, where Verna shows up and she lays like a token on each grave. And it's representative of that person's death. It's like the cat collar for Leo. It's the mask for Perry, et cetera, et cetera. And I was like, none of these people deserve it. I feel like that would have been such a more powerful moment if all she did was lay the feather on Lenore's grave and leave the rest empty. Just nothing. Mm-hmm. No acknowledgement of the rest of them. Just leave the feather for Lenore, who was truly the only innocent party. I mean, arguably Perry a little bit, but...
The thing I remember more is, the Dupin thing. And it's like... This really cements this whole show as this wish fulfillment.
Yeah.
This fantasy of like, I'm going to go home to my wife and kids,
and
our love is more meaningful than any of the wealth you'll ever have. You know,
notably, it's not wife and kids. He does say he.
I apologize.
Male pronouns. So we learn that Dupin is an elderly gay man.
Yes.
I love for him.
Yeah.
But he's
going
making
home
the point
to my partner and kids, you know, like
he's going home to his husband and their kids and their grandkids. And he is saying, I am the rich man because I have this family and this love, which is truly how we comfort ourselves in a world that is completely broken.
Exactly. It's
we
like,
must be happier than rich people.
That's exactly right. We must be happier than rich people. That's kind of
which we probably are. The ones I've met are fucking miserable.
Maybe, you know, that's the fantasy that shows like Succession and this show indulges, like, hey, they might have every one of their material needs met, but they are truly miserable on the inside. But I don't know. I don't buy it.
I also just kind of felt like, again,
I think a lot of them are happy. That's what I'm saying.
But it's anyway. The ill marriage of the Poe stuff and the pharmaceutical catharsis stuff, the Ligodone stuff is... I don't think we needed the show to make that point. I mean, I love it for Dupin to be like, I didn't get to prosecute my case. They dismissed it because you're all dead. I retired. I'm going home to my family. Fuck you forever. That's great for him. But I was like, I don't need the whole, like, I'm really the rich man because my family loves me and you're all dead. I didn't need that. I didn't really need the moral of the story.
Right.
It's like, I don't fucking need... This could have just been... The ushers are a weird fucking family. and they're all dying in these weird fucking ways. And there's this weird fucking lady. And is it connected? Is it supernatural? Is it a curse? Or is it just an epically bad run of luck for this these terrible people are making terrible decisions and they're dying? Is that a curse, or are they just terrible people making terrible decisions? And, you know, I think it would have just been totally fine just as that.
I completely agree. I think it's much more sprawling than that, and it goes into different time periods, and there's this,
well, again,
there's this Carla Gugino character that may or may not, like, or actually is real in the context of the show. But I think you're right that if it had been a little bit less pat, if it had been a little bit more ambiguous, I think it would have been a stronger show.
And I just think that's take all the pharmaceutical stuff out of it. I really believe Mike Flanagan had two ideas, the opioid show and the Poe show.
I don't
and
actually
probably should have been separate things.
You brought this up when I first like invited you to do this with me, and I don't know that I agree, because there's nothing inherently wrong with using pharmaceuticals, in my opinion. Like,
no,
what is he going to do? He has to explain somehow.
No, he doesn't. They're just weird rich people. They're just a generationally wealthy rich family, and it could be a lean, mean, gothic horror of these creepy, weird rich people having creepy, weird deaths. Do not answer the question about Verna. Is she magic? Is she not? Leave that ambiguous.
I agree with that last part, but I think in the world we live in today, it is borderline irresponsible to make a show about rich people that is this tone and not comment on wealth in some way.
I think, like, the comment is they are making bad decisions. Prospero makes a bad decision. Leo makes a bad decision. They make bad decisions. They make selfish decisions. We see them, like you said, with Camille, they are all forcing people to do things against their will. They're using Arthur Pym, their fixer, for bad things. They're cleaning up messes. Like, I had a question after Telltale Heart. I'm like, wait, did the public in this world find out that Victorine murdered her wife? Or was that cleaned up?
There?
Like, we don't know. And I'm assuming cleaned up. I'm assuming that Pym made all of that look okay. That somehow he made all of that look like, oh, it's a murder-suicide, but the wife did it and Victorine was the tragic victim. Like I feel like Pym just fixed it. Like, but we never really know. I feel like that would be the commentary on the rich people, is they're rich. We already hate them. And they're making bad decisions. We see them making these selfish, awful choices. And every time they're given an out, she tells Prospero, we can leave. She tells Leo, don't adopt the cat. They choose to do selfish things and they die. And that's enough. I really don't think it needs more explanation than we see them making selfish, bad decisions.
I don't know that the show is completely successful. In fact, for me, it definitely wasn't completely
it's
successful.
Not but successful.
But I don't think it was a bad idea to try and relate the House of the Ushers to an actual modern day social issue. And whether or not he succeeded, you can decide. You seem to think it really makes for a poor grafting on. I think the show honestly has bigger problems than that. Mostly around tone and around performance and around, like, matching the past and the present and making sure these characters are consistent. Those are the biggest issues for me. But I had no issues with, like, thematically, the Ushers were into some terrible shit that made society worse. That happens to be something we recognize, you know?
Yeah, so. And maybe if they fixed, like, the tone problem and we saw the progression from young Madeline and Roderick to old Madeline, maybe if all that was connected, that other stuff would have worked out a little bit better.
Yeah, maybe,
But I feel like it's just, to me, it's just a mixed bag. There's a lot of individual elements that I like. Performance-wise, production design, some of, like you said, the kills are very well realized. And some of the individual horror moments, a couple of the adaptations are really good. But then you have things like, I hated what they did to Rue Morgue. I just hated that so much. And then you have those issues of, like, the tone doesn't connect, the performances don't connect. There's just some stuff that, again, like, I feel like this needed a little bit more time in the oven.
Yeah.
A little bit more baking time.
A real mixed bag, but still worth talking about and thinking about and watching.
Yeah, and so, it's not like I wouldn't recommend it. I would say if you like Mike Flanagan, if you like Edgar Allan Poe, by all means, watch it. It's just probably not going to be your favorite Flanagan thing.
I think you're right about that. I completely agree. So I think we can wrap it up on that note of agreement. Sarah Mars, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find my work on laneygossip.com or on the Squawk Substack. That's new.
Oh, yeah. What's the Squawk Substack?
It's an offshoot of Laney Gossip where we do deeper dives into pop culture, gossip history. Last week and this week, my boss, Laney Louis, did a deep dive into the Beckhams of 2004 with the docuseries. It's on Netflix. She was revisiting the scandals and trials and tribulations of the Beckhams in 2003 and 4, which is just a horrible fashion rewind, just really bad hair decisions and clothing decisions, just very bad all the way around, but also interesting from a perspective of a celebrity power couple who went through the meat grinder and came out like they're cultural institutions now. They're the Beckhams.
Yeah.
So she did that. So it's just kind of longer, deeper dives into pop culture and gossip history.
Very cool. You can find more episodes of this podcast at podcast.decodingtv.com. Email us at decodingtv@gmail.com. Let us know what you think. And we are going to be continuing to cover Loki right here on Decoding TV. So keep it tuned in for that. Me and Patrick are covering that show, having a lot of fun doing it. Okay. Until next time, thanks for listening to Decoding TV. We'll see you later.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.